Nukes and the DOE. Think the Department of Energy is a neutral government agency looking out for the energy concerns of the little gal and the little guy? Get real. The DOE has consistently proven itself anything but neutral in its work with all things nuclear. And that comes into sharp focus when one considers the U.S. Department of Energy's Savannah River site, or SRS, in Southern California. When DOE ignores serious questions raised by private citizens and NGOs about the site's radioactive waste and planned production of plutonium pits for new nuclear weapons, it takes a genuine expert, a veteran of decades of work bird-dogging the problems at SRS, to boil it down to the essence. And when he tells you,
DOE is really the Department of Nuclear Weapons. It's not just the Department of Energy. And people get confused about that. And DOE tries to hide behind the fact that it's really the Department of Nuclear Weapons because they have produced the materials and are still producing nuclear weapons materials. And they assemble and disassemble all the nuclear warheads.
And he's got the facts to back that up. Well, when Tom Clements, director of Savannah Riverside Watch, points out the true orientation of the DOE, the Department of Energy, that we seem to overlook, and backs it up with plenty of data and information, you understand that it's just another symptom of that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevy. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we take a close look at the problems at the Savannah River site in South Carolina. It's a 310 square mile, or 800 square kilometer, complex built during the 1950s to produce plutonium and tritium for nuclear weapons. Now, it's being pressed into operation to manufacture new plutonium pits, the explosive core for every nuclear weapon. What does that mean? What are the problems at the site? And what is and is not being done about it? We talk with Tom Clements, director of Savannah Riverside Watch, an NGO working for the public interest by monitoring activities at SRS and other DOE and commercial nuclear projects in the southeastern U.S. region. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Jack Cohen Joppa, the nuclear resistor, with another story of our shared history of successful activist resistance, and more honest nuclear information than we ever learned during the government shutdown. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, November 11, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out with a look at U.S. funding priorities. Military spending, especially nuclear weapons in the Golden Dome, versus SNAP and other basic human needs. Here's Linda Penn-Scummer to parse it out in this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
Millions of Americans are starting to struggle to feed their families now that SNAP benefits, the acronym for the Food Stamps Program, have been taken away from them by the Trump administration, driven by the Republican government shutdown. Millions more are preparing for a massive hike in the costs of health insurance under what is now the inaptly named Affordable Care Act, an increase that could have been prevented were it not for the prolonged shutdown. Thanks to the President Trump-imposed tariffs, many essential goods are also about to become unaffordable. But on Sunday, Trump conducted a flyover in Air Force One over the home stadium of the Commanders, Washington, D.C.'s NFL team, then attended part of the game. He arrived late and left early, but reportedly did not nod off in between. He also bragged to reporters, "Was that the greatest flyover ever?" As Washington Post sports columnist Barry Sraluga wrote, "During the stoppage, the military doesn't have the funds for military flyovers at sports events. The president, we know by now, can do whatever he wants." On a side note, it's telling that the best political writing in the Washington Post is now being carried out on the sly on its sports pages, where the Bezos censors have apparently not yet caught up. At times like these, it's appropriate to speculate what those billions directed toward military spending could pay for if they were instead put into social needs. Well, there's a project of the Institute for Policy Studies that helps us understand the answer to that question, and many more, about our federal budgeting process. It's called the National Priorities Project. The NPP produces handy and frankly shocking pie charts that show immediately that almost half of the discretionary federal budget goes toward military spending before we even begin to address everyday human needs. But let's take one example that NPP provides. It has a page showing the costs for the so-called War on Terror, broken down into various categories. Taken all together, U.S. taxpayers are spending $93.26 million an hour for the War on Terror. Yes, an hour. Below this stat, which has a live ticker showing the mounting billions spent this year and counting, there is a tab with the headline, "Trade-offs. What else could these dollars buy?" On that page, you can actually create your own budget. In other words, you get to choose where you would cut from, nuclear weapons is given as one example, and where you would spend it instead. Elsewhere on the site is an article by Hannah Holmsted called "MAGA Priorities, Golden Dome Over Hungry Families," which does a direct analysis between the spending on Trump's exorbitant and almost certainly unreliable and maybe even undeliverable planned missile defense project and delivering SNAP to needy families, roughly 42 million people. As Holmsted writes, $8 billion is what would be needed to fund SNAP for the month of November. But the Trump administration has kept available $156 billion in Pentagon funding for its warfighting priorities, including $24 billion for what she calls Trump's absurd Golden Dome project, a dangerous fantasy that funnels taxpayer dollars to Pentagon contractors like SpaceX, Palantir, and Lockheed Martin, who profit from endless war. That's effectively 3 months' worth of SNAP benefits wasted on something that may never be realized and won't work at least 50% of the time or more if past missile defense system records are any guide. There's another section on the NPP site that compares spending on climate action with the amounts funneled to the Pentagon. As a reminder, many of these figures are still from the previous Biden administration, and much of the skewed imbalance is thanks to Congress, not the White House. As the NPP writes, in fiscal year 2023 alone, nearly two-thirds of the federal discretionary budget funded the military-industrial complex and militarized spending, dwarfing public investment in climate action. Between 2014 and 2024, Congress gave 40 times more toward foreign military finance than it did toward the Green Climate Fund, the primary fund for international climate resilience. Nuclear weapons, of course, are the big kahuna when it comes to excessive and unnecessary spending that steals from social programs. Last year, each individual taxpayer spent $3,707 for weapons of war, $115 of that specifically for nuclear weapons. That's based on a current spending rate of nuclear weapons of about $50 billion a year over the next decade, according to the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. The so-called modernization of the nuclear weapons arsenal is expected to cost as much as $2 trillion. There's a wonderful classic peanut strip in today's paper featuring Peppermint Patty, my favorite character. She's in math class wrestling with subtraction and is asked to explain it. "Subtraction is the awful feeling that you know less today than you did yesterday," she declares. It's also the awful feeling that far too much is being subtracted from our tax dollars to ensure nuclear war is more likely and day-to-day survival far harder for too many. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
And now it's milk and cookies time with another story of heroism in the fight against nuclear weapons with Jack Cohen-Joppa, the nuclear resistor.
The most lethal and threatening leg of the United States nuclear trinity of air, land, and sea-launched warheads are the Trident nuclear submarines. They run silent and deep beneath all seven seas. But the same deep oceans where submarines can hide also complicate communication with commanders on shore. One solution was to use low or extremely low-frequency radio waves. Decades ago, deep in the North Woods of Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula, over 80 miles of large aluminum cable was strung from thousands of wood utility poles. Anchored deep in the granite bedrock, they created a ground-based antenna known as Project ELF for extremely low-frequency transmission. But the extremely low frequency is also extremely slow. Think 15 minutes for a three-letter code, and the sub can't even reply. Project ELF was designed to send one-way messages to submerged Trident submarines, calling them to the surface to take the launch order for a nuclear first strike. The sole function of Project ELF was to simply ring the bell to start a nuclear war. Naturally, the North Woods locals took offense to this foolhardy project to electrify the forests where they work and play just to win the war that will end the world. So even before the linesmen got to work, the Stop Project ELF campaign arose to educate the public in both states about the health risk of ELF and the existential risk of its mission. Experts testified that ELF's military necessity was highly overrated. Opponents gathered enough political support to get Wisconsin's Attorney General to sue the Navy over the environmental violations. And amid the growing waves of anti-nuclear civil disobedience in the 1980s, the Citizens for Alternatives to Trident ELF took up a parallel campaign of nonviolent direct action. Between 1983 and 1987, almost 40 people were arrested for climbing fences at the two transmitter sites in Michigan and Wisconsin. Three men in separate actions each used hand saws to cut through one or more of the poles, risking injury to slow construction and testing of the system, and each served up to 22 months in state custody. Meanwhile, in 1984, a federal judge agreed that the Navy was violating federal law because it had ignored studies showing human health hazards from ELF's electromagnetic radiation. When that ruling was vacated on appeal, the legal path to stop Project ELF reached a dead end, and ELF began full operations in 1989. Direct action advocates took a step back to regroup. In 1991, NukeWatch, a scrappy nonprofit out of Madison, picked up the baton for a growing coalition still determined to chase this ELF out of the woods. NukeWatch even moved to northern Wisconsin, and over the next 13 years, a renewed direct action campaign supported nearly 60 nonviolent actions at the Wisconsin facility, resulting in 600 more arrests. Some repeat resistors racked up four or more citations. Many refused to pay fines, and at least 40 people served days or even months in jail instead. And for a time, the court even suspended driver's licenses for unpaid fines. But the courts were not a total bust. On Earth Day 1996, Tom Hastings and Donna Howard, in a plowshares action they named the Laurentian Shield after that granite bedrock, took a two-handled saw and cut down three more poles. At trial that September, they won a jury acquittal on state sabotage charges after expert testimony showed that Project ELF and Trident can only be used in a manner that violates U.S. law against war crimes of indiscriminate death and destruction. When county officials eventually grew weary of carrying the Navy's water in court, the federal government took over prosecutions in 2001, and some ELF activists spent up to 6 months in federal prison, including NukeWatch organizer Bonnie Erfer. Then, in September 2004, the continuing resistance came to a sudden and surprising end. The Navy announced that ELF would be turned off and dismantled at the end of that month. It was outdated and no longer needed, they said, the same argument opponents had been making for 30 years. This ELF was evicted, and direct action, including over 9 years of peace witness from behind bars, finally got the goods. The last 20 people awaiting trial in federal court had their charges dismissed as moot. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat with another tale from the archives of the Nuclear Resistor to inspire your activism today.
We have a picture of one of those actions up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 750. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, here we go. I leave tomorrow to cover the International Uranium Film Festival in Window Rock, Navajo Nation, which is located in Arizona near Gallup, New Mexico. Hold a good thought that my planned 3.5-hour lead time will be long enough to get me through the TSA gridlock in time to catch my flight. But it's worth it to know that I'll be seeing friends as well as films, networking on behalf of the show, conducting interviews, and doing my best to capture the essence of this international ingathering of filmmakers, activists, and strong indigenous representation and leadership. I feel it's important to have eyes on at various events dealing with nuclear issues to bring you news and information you won't get from any other media outlet. This is the on-the-ground work of activists and our allies around the world who are moving us towards a nuclear-free future. That's why I try to attend as many of these events in the year as I can, limited only by time, energy, and, oh yes, that all-important money to cover my expenses, which includes flights, ground transportation, housing, and meals. This is over and above the monthly costs of running Nuclear Hot Seat, and the only possible source of these necessary funds is from you. So, Window Rock I'll be going to, but I still need your help in covering the expenses, which are already out of pocket. So if you can help me with this trip to cover the International Uranium Film Festival for Nuclear Hot Seat listeners such as yourself, please consider making a donation. We make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible and will only take a moment. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, or you can send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com, and that way no fees get taken out. Know that no donation amount is too small, none is too large, so don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate to cover my Window Rock expenses now, and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. We're taking a look at the problems of the Savannah River site in South Carolina. It's a 310 square mile, 800 square kilometer complex built during the 1950s to produce plutonium and tritium for nuclear weapons, and it currently employs about 10,000 people. Now it's being pressed into operation to be one of only two sites in the country to manufacture plutonium pits, the explosive, highly radioactive core necessary for every nuclear weapon. But what does that mean about the dangers to the on-site working population? The need for site cleanup? What's to be done about the ever-increasing amount of radioactive waste? And why do we need more nukes in the first place? To learn what's going on, we turned to a genuine expert. Tom Clements has been director of Savannah River Site Watch, a public interest organization in Columbia, South Carolina, since 2014. SRS Watch monitors U.S. Department of Energy management of weapons-usable materials, nuclear weapons production, and cleanup of high-level nuclear waste, with a focus on the Savannah River site. I spoke with Tom Clements on November 7, 2025. There was a press release I received from Savannah River Site Watch that included a quote from the director of SRS Watch, and in it he said, DOE, meaning the Department of Energy's commercial plutonium program, is unacceptable and dangerous, will waste vast sums of taxpayer money, has little chance of success, and must be terminated. But other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, what did you think of the play? My guest today is Tom Clements of Savannah River Site Watch, the director of it, and the source of that quote. Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
First of all, explain, what is Savannah River Site Watch and what do you do?
We're a small nonprofit organization. We were founded in 2014, but I've been around since the late 1980s working on U.S. Department of Energy issues. SRS Watch, if people know anything about the Department of Energy nuclear weapons and nuclear waste complex, Savannah River Site is one of the largest facilities in that complex, 300 square miles, located here in South Carolina, where I'm located. We mostly monitor things going on related to waste management, plutonium management, growing role in the nuclear weapons production, and now small modular reactors with AI centers. There's just a whole host of things going on at Savannah River Site, rather like a lot of the other Department of Energy sites. And I would add, DOE is really the Department of Nuclear Weapons. It's not just the Department of Energy. And people get confused about that. And DOE tries to hide behind the fact that it's really the Department of Nuclear Weapons because they have produced the materials and are still producing nuclear weapons materials. And they assemble and disassemble all the nuclear warheads.
How much of this work is being done at SRS?
Savannah River Site traditionally produced about 36 metric tons, and people might not know exactly what that is, but 36,000 kilograms of plutonium. And about 2 or 3 kilograms is enough to make the pit that goes into a weapon, the sphere that goes into the heart of the weapon. Congress, DOE, Department of Defense wants to build a new facility at Savannah River Site to make the plutonium pits for nuclear weapons. So that's a main thing we're tracking. They also want to do that at the Los Alamos site in New Mexico. But the production of those many tons of plutonium created a vast amount of nuclear waste. They filled 51 million gallon tanks with high-level nuclear waste. And we're headed towards about 41 of those tanks left with high-level nuclear waste in them. About 35 million gallons of high-level nuclear waste. They got to get the waste out. They got to vitrify it. It's a big threat to the environment of South Carolina and Georgia. That's one of the main things we're tracking as well.
When you say they need to vitrify it, explain what that means.
They do have an active program, and I'm afraid because of the emphasis on nuclear weapons production that the environmental so-called cleanup at Savannah River Site and all the other Department of Energy sites is going to be a threat. Hanford in Washington State also has high-level nuclear waste. And the plan, at least here at Savannah River Site, is to pump that waste out. I mean, you can't get anywhere near it. It has to be remote pumping.
That's because of the radiation level?
Oh, yeah. It's lethal. And basically, they pump it into a facility that mixes that stream of high-level nuclear waste in a highly shielded facility with hot glass. And that glass is blended with the high-level nuclear waste right at the point where they fill big canisters that are about 2 feet by 10 feet tall. And they pour the glass in there, and by remote handling, they take them to a storage area, and there's about 4,000 of those canisters at Savannah River Site, a byproduct of plutonium production, a byproduct of the Cold War. Sites that produce these materials from the Cold War, we're still catching the brunt of it. There's no place for that waste to go. It's high-level nuclear waste under law. And right now, under law, spent nuclear fuel from the commercial nuclear power plants around the country and the Department of Energy's high-level waste, in this case, the vitrified waste in those canisters, they're all supposed to go into an underground geologic repository. That does not exist.
With the problem of all of this waste, SRS is now being tasked with the creation of more plutonium pits, which are the firing mechanism, the ignition mechanism for nuclear weapons. Why and how is this being approached?
Oh, why? That's a good question. I scratch my head about that every day. And let me just add, I'll answer your question, but to make the pits, they're going to be creating more nuclear waste at Savannah River Site. And some of that would be low-level waste dumped into unlined trenches on the site. Some of it would go as plutonium waste or transuranic waste to a facility in southern New Mexico called the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, underground salt mine. And there are hundreds of dump pits on Savannah Riverside for chemicals. And they've capped over a lot of them, but a lot of that stuff is seeping in. So while Savannah Riverside was on a cleanup path, they came along with this proposal to make plutonium pits in a facility that was half constructed to make plutonium fuel for commercial nuclear reactors out of surplus plutonium. That project was canceled after wasting $10 billion. Now they want to build this pit facility to make 50 or more of the pits, the core of the warhead, as you said. And the question is, why? These are for new warheads. So it really shows, and this started basically under President Obama and continued under Biden and now to Trump, and it's picking up speed. They want to make these for new nuclear warheads. It's not to maintain the existing warheads. So then you ask why? And it sure looks like to me there's a planned nuclear arms race here. They like to throw around the word deterrence. They're only for deterrence. Well, it's come more and more that deterrence means planning for full-scale nuclear war. It's really quite shocking once you start getting into all this.
The government is poised to release almost 20 metric tons of surplus weapons-grade plutonium, which is enough plutonium for 4,000 nuclear weapons, to be fabricated into fuel to be used in sodium-cooled fast reactors. What's wrong with this, and what's wrong with the path that this would be setting us down?
This goes really deep, but the first thing is, the U.S. declared about 61 metric tons, and I speak in metric tons because that's the terminology the Department of Energy uses. Metric tons is about 2,200 pounds. So 61.5 tons out of the 106 that were produced in nuclear reactors, defense reactors at DOE sites, is now surplus. And Department of Energy controls this material, or it's inside the weapons, the 4,000 or more nuclear weapons. So this proposal, and I think they put out a request for people to apply for the plutonium, and they have to get the applications in by November 21st, and they're going to make a decision by the end of the year. They would basically give 20 metric tons of weapon-grade plutonium to the commercial nuclear power industry out of DOE hands where there's higher security. We have no idea. There's one company called Oklo, particularly. They want to use it in a reactor that doesn't exist to be fabricated into plutonium fuel in a fuel fabrication facility that doesn't exist. And there's no schedule for the operation of these reactors. There's no schedule for that or cost of that fuel fabrication facility. But introducing weapon-grade plutonium into commercial fuel really sets a bad example internationally, because this is the prime nuclear weapons material. And we do not need to be setting an example where plutonium weapons material can be used as a nuclear fuel. Commercial uranium, at the level it's at, it can't be used as a nuclear fuel. I mean, even if you're against nuclear power, at least the uranium fuel right now cannot, the uranium in it can't be used to fuel a nuclear weapon.
Right now, my understanding is that for the large nuclear reactors that do exist, the uranium fuel is enriched to 5%, which is too low for an explosion. But the fuel that needs to be enriched for small modular nuclear reactors, also known as SMRs or SMNRs or advanced or mini reactors, or there are a lot of euphemisms for them, but that the fuel for that, called HALEU, high assay low enriched uranium, could be used in a very dirty version of an exploding nuclear weapon. So that is another risk that is out there.
Correct. And that HALEU, which is up to 20% of the isotope of uranium that can be used in fission, uranium-235, there was a very helpful report last year that it can be used in nuclear weapons. And the government is moving very fast to use this 20% enriched uranium as nuclear fuel in small modular reactors. And I have to add, small modular reactors don't exist. The reactor I was just talking about to be fueled with plutonium by Oklo doesn't exist. So they're pushing something full scale for reactors that don't exist. And the HALEU has nuclear weapons, explosive risk to it, and using plutonium as a nuclear fuel has proliferation and nuclear weapons concerns. And I would add that the reactor that you mentioned, this sodium-fueled reactor, it would use HALEU initially, and then it would shift to plutonium from what the government would give it. And then the next step, and this may be the most shocking thing, they want to use a new technique that hasn't been tested to remove plutonium, weapon usable plutonium, from commercial spent nuclear fuel, irradiated nuclear fuel that's stored all around the country at the commercial nuclear power plants, because those commercial nuclear power plants are producing plutonium right now as we speak, and it's weapon usable. So Oklo wants to build a certain kind of reprocessing plant to remove that plutonium to build this whole infrastructure that would rely on reactor-grade plutonium coming from the commercial fuel to fuel their reactors in the future. The whole thing is just, technologically, it's very challenging for them to pull this off. The Department of Energy is really trying to help Oklo pull this off, and I view Oklo and DOE as partners. Partners in giving away the plutonium, partners in building the plutonium fuel reactors, partners in building the plutonium fuel facility, partners in building a reprocessing plant to remove plutonium from commercial spent fuel. And the whole thing is very heinous to me, concerned about nuclear proliferation, reactor safety, the waste produced. And I think there, maybe it's an overreach from cost and technological and safety concerns.
It seems like the last thing we need is more plutonium, let alone plutonium in non-military, non-really overseen by government entities, to be able to be used in any way that the commercial entity wants it to be. Your group recently sent out a press release that states, "It appears that DOE is prepared to skirt requirements of the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, which has been used for two decades. What are those requirements and why are they important?"
Yes. If you read what's called the request for applications to try to get this, it's actually 19.7 metric tons, but the 20 metric tons, it has some language in there about following environmental law. But the way it's written, and there's been an effort, particularly by the current administration, to weaken environmental impact statements and the requirements of the National Environmental Policy Act, which controls environmental impact statements. It appears to me that they want to try to get around the requirements of that environmental law, NEPA, as easily as they can. But their problem is, since 1996, there have been environmental impact statement analyses on what to do with this surplus plutonium. And at first, they were going to use it as a nuclear fuel. They started building facilities at Savannah River Site. That fell apart. Then they decided they were going to mix it with a secret ingredient and take it to this plutonium waste facility in New Mexico, the waste isolation pilot plant. So for well over 20 years, there have been a lot of environmental analyses done, EISs and amendments. So now it looks to me like they want to give away the 20 metric tons and just do something that's going to be very cursory. And I kind of put that news release out as a flag to them. You are opening yourselves to a legal challenge. And I can go into it because we had a huge victory under that environmental law earlier this year. And I think DOE is going to be vulnerable to a legal challenge that could stop a lot of this.
I find it interesting you're talking about a legal challenge, because certainly the current administration in the White House has not shown itself to be particularly responding to legal challenges or legal edicts or judicial judgments. How effective do you think that this legal challenge would be, and what form would it take?
You're, of course, right that they are trying to gut environmental laws. They're trying to ignore court rulings and do just anything. But there's quite a long history of these environmental analyses on what to do with plutonium disposition. And I'm somewhat heartened, actually, because my organization, SRS Watch, along with a group in New Mexico, Nuclear Watch New Mexico, that monitors Los Alamos nuclear weapons site, and a group in California, Tri-Valley Cares, that monitors a nuclear weapons design facility at Livermore, California, we won a major NEPA, environmental lawsuit, and came to a settlement with the Department of Energy in January of this year, right before the current administration came in. We won the lawsuit, and now DOE's National Nuclear Security Administration, the nuclear weapons part of it, they are having to conduct what's called a programmatic environmental impact statement on plutonium pit production, those 50 pits or more they want to produce at Savannah Riverside and 30 at Los Alamos. The draft environmental impact statement, programmatic EIS, is probably going to be out in February, and then there'll be opportunity for public comment. And so far, NNSA, DOE, the Trump administration, they're honoring the NEPA lawsuit we won via a settlement agreement. They have not tried to skirt the settlement agreement that was basically authorized by the federal court here in Columbia, South Carolina. So the judge saw that the Department of Energy had not complied with environmental law. So we won. I mean, it's rather shocking. It was a major environmental victory that I don't think it's been reported enough. And I'm of the mind, if they try to get away with this plutonium giveaway scheme without doing proper review, that they're going to open themselves to a robust legal challenge.
We will cheer you on and follow this every step of the way as long as you keep us in the loop.
Will do.
The report that you've referenced a few times was just recently put out by Savannah Riverside Watch. And in it, you have a list of chapters and areas that you focused on that were listed in the press release. Could you go over a few of those that perhaps we haven't touched upon yet that are areas of concern?
Cost is on people's minds right now. We have no idea how much this whole plutonium system would cost. Reactors, the reprocessing of spent fuel, the fuel fabrication facility. They want to model these reactors on a reactor that was based at another DOE site and closed down about 30 years ago. It was an experimental breeder reactor too in Idaho, Idaho National Lab. I'm not aware of how they're going to get the design information for that reactor, why we would allow, if there's any sensitive information, to get into the company's hands. Just like the small modular reactors you mentioned, they want Oklo and there are other companies that are interested in well. They want a government handout at every step of the way. So this would have to be heavily subsidized for the reactors, for the fuel fabrication, for this reprocessing facility, which would be built at a DOE site or near it. They're going to have to get government handouts paid for by the taxpayer. And there's no reason we should be subsidizing. I can't call it anything else but a harebrained scheme. But DOE is taking it seriously. And we know that they're taking a lot of stuff that's kind of wacky very seriously. And they're going to attempt to drain the budget down on projects like this, just like people may have read that DOE wants to fund $80 billion for some Westinghouse reactors. And we've got experience with that here in South Carolina, where building these same reactors failed. Where are they going to get the $80 billion for 10 nuclear reactors? It's out of the taxpayer's pocket. So none of this can stand on its own. It's private business, but it can't stand on its own. And here's the clincher on it all. The Secretary of Energy, Chris Wright, was on the board of directors of the company that's the main company trying to get the plutonium, Oklo. And Senator Markey and some others wrote some letters saying there's a huge conflict of interest here. And when I heard he was nominated to be Secretary of Energy, I knew right then that Oklo was going to be getting something. And that's what's happening. So that's most unfortunate. But people need to keep an eye on the Secretary of Energy because he's got a major conflict of interest. So he has been funneling money out the door to these SMR projects. They don't even exist. Only one of them has a design approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and none of them can stand on their own. These reactor designs can't stand on their own. So you got to be very cautious about the Secretary of Energy and what he's up to.
Is there anything else you want to go over that was covered in the press release that you sent out?
Let me cover one thing that's kind of worth a chuckle. I'm not looking at the language right now, but this company, Oklo, in presenting their reactors as the most wonderful thing ever, and that they would solve all environmental problems and provide for economic justice and equality for people, they use the exact terms that were like DEI terms. And when I was reading that right in the report, I went, hold on a second. This is a woke reactor. And they have stripped all that language out, I am sure. But it was under the end of the Biden administration. So I started thinking, and I didn't put this in the report, but I was very tempted to call it the Woklo reactor. And that's, so they, you know, they were saying this is for economic justice. Well, it's just for their economic justice, not for the people. But to go back and catch that buried in one of the documents was quite funny. So I might be tempted to call this the Woklo reactor going forward.
Let's shift this a little, because the big news over the last week was when President Trump announced that he wanted to resume nuclear weapons testing. This, of course, kicked our collective adrenal glands into overdrive at the thought of atmospheric testing. And then, I believe, engaging the response to it, there was a dial back that there would be no atmospheric testing, but maybe underground testing. And then a further dial back, well, no underground testing, it would just be the systems that deliver nuclear weapons. Specifically, that was not referenced in his initial announcement. It was like the pattern of, let's do something that's going to blow people's minds and get them all upset initially, and then move it back and move it back and move it back. But meanwhile, we've expended all this energy and this attention on our outrage, which exhausts us, and our energy, our resources are not infinite. But given that he is still thinking in this way, alarm bells have gone off, and SRS is one of only two sites, the other one, as you mentioned, being in Los Alamos in New Mexico, working towards increasing the production of plutonium pits. How does the president's recent actions, this threat or promise, or maybe not, or maybe so, to resume nuclear testing in any form, impact what's happening on SRS as regards the pits?
Well, what Trump said about resuming testing was both ignorant and provocative, as he is prone to be on everything. And as you said, things were dialed back. And the energy secretary, who I just mentioned, who has a conflict of interest with small modular reactors, he basically said, we're just talking about what's called subcritical nuclear tests. These are tests that use, I don't know, a gram or two of plutonium, where they are in chambers underground at the nuclear test site in Nevada, where hundreds of nuclear weapons were exploded underground, and there was atmospheric testing there. And a lot of the atmospheric testing, of course, was in the Pacific, and there's still radioactive damage and threats to the people out there. So he says, we were just talking about these subcritical tests that are done in chambers, and the reaction doesn't go so-called critical, where it would form a nuclear reaction. And the U.S. has been doing these, as much as we may not like them, because they're used to validate the design parameters for nuclear warheads. I mean, the good part of it is they're not doing full-scale testing. But I think Trump refuted what the Secretary of Energy said, and no, we want to test the weapons. And see, there's a lot of problems with this, because the test site is not ready for that anyway. It would take years. But in Project 2025, I didn't go back and look at the language, but I think they wanted to have a six-month period where we could return to nuclear weapons testing. And this would basically stimulate Russia and China and everybody else that wants new design nuclear weapons to do the same thing. And China might learn more from testing than the United States, because we're technologically ahead of them. So testing might only serve the Chinese, not the United States and new designs. But my fear is somebody was whispering into Trump's ear that we need to test those new pits that Savannah River site and Los Alamos are doing. Now, you won't read about this in any news articles, but I just wonder if somebody grabbed his ear. We're building all these new pits. We need to test them. And I think we might be hearing more about, once they get to this 80 pit level they want to build by the mid-2030s or so, later than that, actually, that they might want to test some of the new pits. And Nuclear Watch New Mexico, a fellow group, has been sounding the alarm that that could be one of the things that's going on here. They want to test the new plutonium pit. It's a hollow sphere with 2 or 3 kilograms of plutonium. And so that's my fear as far as impacting Savannah Riverside or Los Alamos. Yeah, it's all just crazy. I mean, we should be headed in the opposite direction toward disarmament, not more nuclear weapons testing and building more nuclear weapons. And all of these are for new nuclear weapons. There's a long list of new nuclear weapons that's going to cost who knows how many hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, it's just crazy.
What are the coming steps, without giving away any of your strategy, that SRS Watch and these other groups are intending to slow down, to stop, to interfere with, to change the trajectory that we're currently on as regarding the increase of nuclear weapons?
You know, that's a tough one for public interest groups working on these issues, working for arms control or disarmament, or working on the Department of Energy facilities that actually produce the weapons components and assemble them. Right now, given the political climate, we don't have a lot of allies in Congress. We're kind of hanging on by our fingers. We have some, and I mentioned one of them, Senator Markey. We need to continue to communicate and cultivate those people. I just had a senator's office contact me this week about wanting to know more about the Savannah River site. So I hope members of Congress, who, of course, we can't place much trust in them, are waking up to the threats of the new nuclear arms race and all the nuclear waste that's associated with it. The lawsuit that we won to get them to do this big environmental impact statement on the production of the pits was something that can it's going to slow them down. So we need to find more obstacles to stop them or slow them, but the climate is not great. But we do have a few allies. We got to get through this rough spot here. And I used to be more pessimistic, but I think in the medium term, we can start turning the corner on this stuff. And when you start talking about nuclear weapons testing and nuclear arms race, some people really start paying attention that that's not a good thing. So I'm just waiting for that to sink in, but we're kind of pushed up against a wall in some sense, the public interest groups, but we're still out there. We're still looking for ways to move forward. We're still looking for allies in the public and in Congress. And once we get through a bad period here, I'm optimistic that we can keep fighting away like we did in the past and defeat some of these new nuclear weapons plants and the production of the plutonium pits.
Individuals who would like to work with you will be able to contact you, because I will be including the links on the Nuclear Hot Seat site for them to be able to get directly to you. As regards the report, how can people get a copy of your report, Unleashing Plutonium Proliferation in the U.S. Holds Risks?
You can go to srswatch.org, and it should be the second thing on the left column. So it's right there. Click on the news release, then click on the report. And let me just add, the title, Unleashing Plutonium Proliferation, this is a jab right at the Secretary of Energy. I am so tired of hearing him, and they put it in news releases all the time, unleashing American energy dominance, unleashing American petroleum production. Unleashing is their favorite term. So this was a shot right at them. What you're doing is unleashing plutonium proliferation. So I'm going to be looking to see if they use that term unleashing more. So when people read the title, it's a tongue-in-cheek shot right at the Department of Energy. But it's right there on srswatch.org. You can also sign up there to get updates from us as well.
What's next for the group?
Well, we're planning for this draft environmental impact statement on plutonium pit production to be released early next year, possibly February. We're already trying to line up people that would want to testify at the hearings that are going to be held around the country. The Union of Concerned Scientists is doing some organizing on that. And the member groups of my alliance, the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability, we've got it on our radar, and we need to get, you know, more citizens and groups to speak up against not only the environmental impacts of plutonium pit production, but also to speak up for disarmament. So we're going to have that opportunity soon after that draft document is released in February. So that's where a lot of my attention is focused.
I'm about to go off to the International Uranium Film Festival in Window Rock, which has me thinking about documentary films. Is anyone yet making a documentary about what's been happening with SRS and with SRS Watch?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's kind of no, but some people, and you may have heard about a month or so ago, some radioactive wasps were discovered at the Savannah River site, the radioactive nest on top of the high-level waste tanks. And I had several workers contact me, hey, there's more than one nest, and there are other wildlife, birds, that have been contaminated. And we were aware of turtles and alligators. So that story went viral. I kind of stayed away from it, but I also helped kick it off. But it got the term Savannah River site out in the public. And now it's died out. It was sensational, you know, killer radioactive wasps. And people just really focus on that in the communication sphere that's out there. But I had a student contact me because she heard about the radioactive wasps at a nearby college. And I told her the wasps are the tip of the iceberg. So now she's working on a documentary about Savannah Riverside, linking it back to the wasp and all the attention the wasp brought to high-level nuclear waste at the site. So I've explained it's way deeper than just radioactive wasp nest, which does imply there's leaking radioactive material at the site. So that student project is underway. And, you know, thank God for students who are curious, because we've lost almost all coverage from local TV and the media and national media of Savannah Riverside and the Department of Energy complex. They don't really know what it is. They don't know that DOE makes the nuclear weapons and has a massive amount of nuclear waste. They get it confused with the Department of Defense. But here, this student, who is very sincere in learning, is doing this as a class project. So that's your answer. There's a student working on it. And I am so appreciative of that. And I hope that, you know, whatever she produces, that some people will see it and they'll learn more about what's going on at Savannah Riverside and the Department of Energy complex.
Please have her get in touch with me. I'm also the U.S. ambassador for the International Uranium Film Festival. And whatever she produces would be eligible for consideration for one of their awards.
Oh, I will tell her that. She will be happy to hear it, I'm sure. I just did a 2 to 3 hour interview with her a few days ago, so I will pass on that information. Thank you.
Have her establish the link and we will be in touch. Is there anything we haven't covered that you'd like to put in now?
No, I just, you know, people are kind of overwhelmed with everything that's going on out there right now, and you can pick and choose your issues. And a lot of us have dedicated ourselves to the threats from the Department of Energy and radioactive waste and nuclear weapons. And I would just say we appreciate the support that people give psychologically more than anything, that we're playing an important role really while we're on the cusp of a new nuclear arms race. So thanks for that support. Thanks for paying attention to these things. When Trump says something that's not well thought out, there are those of us who really dig deep in and can counter it. So it's very helpful to know that the public is in support of us. So I guess that's my main message.
And Nuclear Hot Seat is appreciative for the work that you and SRS Watch have been doing and continue to do. And we will always be here as a conduit for you getting your voice out.
On a lot of issues, you've gotten the voice of people out there and interviewed a lot of people over the many years. So that's appreciated too. And this is all part of public education. So what you're doing is quite valuable. Thank you.
And thank you for that. For now, Tom Clements of Savannah Riverside Watch, I want to thank you, as I said, for the work you've been doing and for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much.
Tom Clements, Director of Savannah Riverside Watch. You can visit the website at srswatch.org. We will have a link to it and also the direct link if you want to take a look at their report. They will be up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 750. We will also have a link to a more complete discussion of the lie and threat of nuclear deterrence. It's from Nuclear Hot Seat, number 737, and it's an interview with Melissa Park, the head of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. That will also be on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under the episode 750. Speaking of which,
Activists, shout out.
A big shout out this week to Nuclear Hot Seat. 750 episodes up as of today. How did we do it? 1 week at a time for more than 14 years. My thanks to those of you who have steadfastly supported this show with your comments, your insights, and your donations, and know that the plan is to keep going for as long as possible. So if you haven't already done so, sign up on the yellow opt-in box that's at nuclearhotseat.com and listen for all the news, because the thing about nuclear is there's always more news. And of course, your donations are always welcomed. If you're in the Los Angeles area, save the date, Sunday, November 23rd, because that's when Kat Kramer Films That Save the World will feature On the Beach with a panel discussion. If you haven't seen that film in a movie theater, it's a great opportunity to do so, and the message could not be more pertinent. It's stark, powerful, and just as much a warning as when it was first released in 1959. We have a link on the website to where you can get more information and purchase tickets. And a reminder that if you'd like to support my upcoming trip to Navajo Nation to cover the International Uranium Film Festival, go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button to do whatever you can to help me not only get there, but cover the expenses that are already out of pocket. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 11, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy. Sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel, or what's better for us, go to nuclearhotseat.com, look at that yellow box, you really can't miss it, put in your first name and an email address, and every week you'll get one email with the link and a short description to that show's content. That way you need never miss a single episode. And you'll also make the Google algorithm really happy to see us. Now, you're up close and personal with whatever the nuclear issues are in your part of the world, so help us out. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that to us in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount helps us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as President Kennedy said of his hawkish military advisors during the Cuban Missile Crisis, nuclear deterrence works brilliantly until it stops working. And then none of us will be alive to tell them that they were wrong. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.